What's a tidewater glacier, and how does it vary from some other kinds of glaciers? We're going to find out today. Welcome to Glacier Bay National Park. I'm Elizabeth Harriman.
And I'm Paul Lasley, and join us as we talk to some fascinating people who are going to give us an insight, well, a behind-the-scenes look at one of the most special wilderness areas in the world. We're going to talk to a ranger right now who knows, well, pretty much everything there is to know about tidewater glaciers and glaciers in general right here in Glacier Bay National Park.
Just one of the things that will hopefully make your Holland America cruise into Glacier Bay even more special. Jeff Pietka is a park ranger and naturalist in Glacier Bay National Park, and he's a specialist in many things, as most of the rangers are here, but especially about tidewater glaciers. That's a big part of visiting Glacier Bay. So let's start in the beginning, Jeff. What is a tidewater glacier?
Well, most simply, a tidewater glacier is a glacier that flows, just like a river does, of course it's frozen, that flows all the way down to sea level, to a place where there is seawater, usually salt water, although sometimes we consider glaciers that sit in lakes to be tidewater as well.
So the ice, I think that's hard to get, you know, your mind wrapped around, the intellect, is that ice is actually a fluid moving down the side of a mountain, although it might be hundreds of feet thick and hundreds of miles long, and then it ends up in the water. But now it's not floating on the water. There's maybe as much or more ice under the water as you see from on top. Is that right?
Right. And one trick in imagining the flow of a glacier is to realize that a glacier or ice is just the solid form of H2O. It's essentially a rock. Now, at the bottom of that glacier, that rock is under a lot of pressure, and heat and pressure, if you can imagine, which causes it to flow plastically, almost like if you can imagine rolling a ball of silly putty in your hands. And it flows downhill, but remember again, it's a rock. And so as it flows, that hard rock, the ice of the glacier, is running into other rocks, the mountains around it, the rocks, and the bottom of the valley underneath. And as it flows, it's breaking up that rock, literally tearing chunks of boulders out of the bedrock and breaking the boulders down into rocks, and the rocks bouncing off each other until they become cobbles. The cobbles ground down to gravel, sand, and eventually silt, or here we call it glacial flour, a very, very fine rock powder material, almost like baby powder. And all of that is jumbled together, primarily in front of the glacier, but also along the sides, into what we call a moraine.
This moraine, of course, there's evidence of the prehistoric moraine out there in Icy Strait. Actually, you see the depth charts, and you can actually see the outline of what was this really big glacial moraine. But all the tidewater glaciers have moraines, is that right?
They do. The trick to looking at Glacier Bay is to see it from above and see that it looks a little bit like a river system, and that these glaciers have flowed into each other and been able to advance at different periods of time throughout the entire body of Glacier Bay, the last time as recently as 250 years ago. For a tidewater glacier to advance, all it has to do is have a healthy moraine. These glaciers in particular flow out of very high mountains, the Fairweather Mountains, which are off to your west when you cruise in Glacier Bay, and so they have a lot of force behind them, a lot of weight, that ice flowing downhill. Now, as long as they can keep enough moraine in front of them, and by that I mean the remnants of all of those mountains, the boulders and cobbles and rocks, as long as they can keep enough of that material between the body of ice and the seawater, which you'll think of as very cold, but is relatively warm to a glacier, as long as it can keep some of that moraine between its ice body and the seawater outside, it'll have the opportunity to advance. Where that glacier gets into trouble is, like happened 250 years ago, when it filled all of Glacier Bay and then pushed the moraine, all of that protective material, out into deeper water. That moraine literally fell off into deeper water, and the glacier became overexposed to warm seawater, which causes it to begin retreating. And that is the real story of Glacier Bay, what happens after the ice retreats.
So, Jeff, it's not as simple as some people might think, just the amount of snow falling on a glacier. A lot of other factors are involved as well.
Correct. The amount of snow is extremely important. A glacier can't advance without a lot of snow. Now, in this region, the tidewater glaciers that you see will be fed by snow and ice from the Fairweather Mountain Range. And the Fairweather Mountain Range is very unique. Its highest point here in Glacier Bay National Park is just over 15,000 feet. And on the other side of the Fairweather Range is the Pacific Ocean, which is a huge resource of warm air and wet air. Now, all year long, that warm, wet air comes off the Pacific Ocean, rises up to those heights of 10 and 15,000 feet in little over 15 miles, a very short distance. That air cools, drops precipitation in the mountains, and this happens all year long. Some of our researchers estimate that there is between 100 and 150 feet of snowfall annually. That's feet, not inches, at the heights of the Fairweather Mountains. Much of that snow will survive from one year to the next, not melting. And as it does, over time, the snow from the next year will compact it, and the snow from the next year will compact that, until it gains density and weight. And that is what will eventually cause it to flow. And it's not truly a glacier. One thing that's often misunderstood is that a body of ice is not truly a glacier until it begins to move.
So it's really a lot more complex than it seems. The other thing is, this ice is different from the ice that we find in our drinks, right?
Yeah, we all think that, you know, ice is ice is ice is ice. But in reality, boy, there are great differences in ice. And of course, the ice in a glacier is a whole nother thing.
It is complex, yeah. The ice that you'll find in a glacier is significantly denser than the ice you'll find in a drink, although at base they are essentially the same thing. One of the biggest differences, of course, is simply mass. You'll never find this much freezer ice in one place. But as it builds up and flows, we get to think of it as a glacier. And one of the things that separates freezer ice from glacier ice is its color. Now, freezer ice, because those ice cubes are so small, will never take on the blue color that you may be hoping or expecting to see from the glaciers here in Alaska and in Glacier Bay. What's required to get that blue color is not only density, that's an important part of it, but also depth. Even glacier ice, if you were to get a small piece of it the size of an ice cube from your freezer, would appear clear or even white. But at a certain depth, that is a certain mass, you'll begin to see blue reflected from that iceberg. And this is a function of the density that as the spectrum of light travels into that iceberg, most of the components will be caught, will be essentially captured. And there is just one color in particular, that blue that you'll recognize, that is able to pass through and that comes out to your eye. And that's what we call simply glacier blue, because there is no other color like it.
It really isn't. It's one of the great things about cruising in Glacier Bay is to see that blue. I guess you're right. It doesn't occur anywhere else in nature.
It really doesn't occur anywhere else, that particular blue, although it is related essentially to the same reason that the water is blue and the same reason that the sky is blue.
Blue's actually my favorite color, and Mother Nature seems to like it too. But tell us a little bit about what we see on top of the glaciers. Some glaciers have these sort of streaks. Some of them are almost black. What is that, rocks and dust? What is it that accumulates on top of the glaciers?
Essentially, what you see on top of the glaciers is some of that moraine material. It's bedrock and boulders and cobbles and rocks and gravels and sand and silt. And particularly when you travel to the Marjorie Glacier, that's the one you'll be looking at, the one that will show you some blue and has the opportunity to calve, that is to drop chunks of ice down into the water. There is another glacier right alongside it, and many people miss this. If you're looking at the Marjorie Glacier, off to your right is a glacier that is actually bigger, in fact, twice as wide, and that's the Grand Pacific Glacier. But you may not recognize it as such because it is covered with a layer of rock and rubble, moraine material, and we don't really know how thick that layer is. But essentially, it builds up because that glacier is not flowing into the ocean. If you look closely at the Grand Pacific Glacier, you'll see that even at a high tide, there is a little bit of moraine material, land, essentially, separating the face of the glacier from the water. Now, we still call this glacier a tidewater glacier. It's kind of an arguable point. But what's important to note is that every layer of ice, every unit, say 1 foot of ice in a glacier, carries a certain amount of moraine material in it. And in the case of the Marjorie Glacier, that material is dropped into the sea as it flows forward. Over at the Grand Pacific Glacier, that ice melts where it's sitting. the moraine material then stays in place, settling on top of the next foot or unit of ice. And as the next year passes and another unit of ice will melt, the moraine material from that area will also simply stay put right on top of the glacier. So in places where glaciers are flowing all the way to seawater, they're calving off, dropping big chunks of ice, you'll generally see a white or blue shiny glacier. More often, though, you may actually see these dark glaciers, and that's because they are either retreating or stagnant, that is, stable, but most importantly, not calving ice into the water. They are melting in place or melting back.
One of the interesting things that has come to me from being here in Glacier Bay is that some of the glaciers are advancing, some are retreating, some are just stable. This must be a fascinating place to study glaciology.
It is, absolutely, and it brings out one of the key differences between tidewater glaciers and terrestrial glaciers, which are essentially all of the others, and that is a matter of their ability to advance and retreat. In particular, those tidewater glaciers are advancing behind their moraine, and a tidewater glacier with a healthy amount of snow and ice, like the glaciers coming out of the Fairweather Mountains have a lot of potential to advance, and we don't always know where that potential advance point is. But so long as they keep moraine in front of them, they can continue to advance. So whereas over the last 250 years, these glaciers have retreated, some of them are actually now advancing. Now that wholesale retreat of virtually all the ice in Glacier Bay was a response to overexposure to seawater, that warm water that melts the ice and undermines the glacier very, very rapidly. Virtually all of these glaciers have retreated until they are up on land, that is not tidewater, at some point or another in the last, say, 50 or 100 years. And many of them, once they've gotten out of the seawater, have looked around and realized, hey, wait a minute, this isn't quite as warm as it was just the other day when I was down there in the water. They've had a chance to regather strength, build up new moraine, and advance. And this is the gist of the tidewater glacier cycle, essentially, that what governs the movement of tidewater glaciers is nothing to do with temperature, but is in fact most related to their exposure to seawater.
Wow, who knew there was so much to glaciers? And you've obviously been studying glaciers in Glacier Bay for quite some time. Do you have a favorite glacier?
I don't know if I have a single favorite glacier, although there are a few that I like to look at from afar, and especially because they're only visible from certain pockets of the park. There's one glacier in particular, the Riggs Glacier, which many people used to visit when it was a tidewater glacier. Very few do now. What I love about the Riggs Glacier, which I should add I've never actually seen up close, is that there are points in Glacier Bay, the lower part of Glacier Bay in particular, when you can see the Riggs Glacier or the middle reaches of it from as much as 40 or 50 miles away.
An imposing glacier, as it were. The primeval glacier that was here must have been something to see.
Absolutely. The ice that eventually forced the local natives, the Hunahtlingit, to leave was at its peak thousands of feet deep. We know this. We look at the depth of Glacier Bay. We find that in some places the bay is 1,400 feet deep. The ice, of course, filled all of that, even that area below sea level. And then looking above sea level, you can see trim lines on the rock, places that represent the highest point of the glacier. And we know that in some places the glacier was as much as 4,000 feet thick.
That's an amazing amount of ice. And at some point, this rapid retreat must have been just amazing to see. I would think the calving alone must have been spectacular.
Yeah, there are certainly a few examples of individuals who traveled in this area and would have liked to explore Glacier Bay and found it absolutely impossible because of that calving and that immense amount of ice. George Vancouver was one in 1794 who, at the time, Glacier Bay was only 5 miles deep. He had no inclination of what really would eventually be Glacier Bay, that little indentation he saw on the shoreline would eventually be as much as 65 miles deep. Even people who came later, the early 20th century, or John Muir in the 1880s, found navigation extremely difficult at a certain point. Now, they could come into Glacier Bay 20 miles or 30 miles, but at some point in their trip, they would be literally stymied in ice to a place where navigation was not only unsafe, but actually impossible.
Jeff, you have just an amazing field of study, and I imagine it changes every day, doesn't it?
It does change every day, and that said, one of the most interesting things is visitors who come here and say, you know, I was here 20 years ago or X number of years ago, and it seemed colder, or they say, it was snowier, or it was greener. And I encourage them to try and experience each day as it is, because it's extremely difficult to compare one day in the past to one day today. That said, if you stay here year after year and you visit again and again, and particularly if you're taking photographs and making some sort of, even if it's amateurish, but some sort of scientific record of what you see, you can definitely see changes. Places where evergreen trees did not used to grow and they have moved in. Places where plant species have changed, or you didn't used to see a certain kind of wildlife in this place. But it does take a long time to view these things. And so we are keen observers, and we're passing all of this information from one generation of park rangers to another so that we can keep track of the things that do change here, which is virtually everything.
With all the change, can you give people maybe cruising in Glacier Bay a sense of one or two things that they might look for that would make the journey more memorable?
Well, as far as the tidewater glaciers go, the first thing you're going to look for is calving. It is a dramatic event, something that we maybe take for granted when we talk about glaciers. And if you're here on a cruise ship, you'll be spending about 1 hour in front of the Marjorie Glacier, which is the place you're most likely to see ice calving. Now, that can come sometimes once in an hour or 10 times in an hour. It is a completely random process, although also continuous. And so I'd encourage you, when you're at those glaciers, to definitely be outside on the deck and face the glacier. Don't take too much time asking questions of other folks. If there's a park ranger nearby, I always say, feel free to ask your questions, but don't look at me. Please keep looking at the glacier. And if I could ask you to do one other thing, it would be to take note of the Grand Pacific Glacier, because that is something that will drive home, in a sense, the power of the ice. That is the root or the source, the primary glacier that provided the ice that filled Glacier Bay just 250 years ago. And that is the defining feature of this bay, of this national park. And if you can imagine that particular glacier, dirty and humble as it might be today, thousands of feet high and flowing towards you, forcing you too out of Glacier Bay, then you'll have a little better grasp, a little extra piece of the history and the change that's possible here in Glacier Bay National Park.
Paul and I have one other thing that we've discovered. When we're up on the deck of the ship, we try to be very quiet and just listen to the glacier.
Absolutely. We refer to it as white thunder. That's the cracking that comes along with calving. If you've ever, well, of course you have. You've pulled a freezer tray, a tray of ice cubes out of the freezer and twisted one end forward and one end back, and you hear all those ice cubes pop out of there. It's like that, but a whole heck of a lot louder. And it does indicate that ice is cracking off. One thing you'll want to remember is that once you've heard that crack, there's a good chance you have missed that calving. So spin and look, but you'll be looking for the after effects, the splash or the wave that result in the water. So keep your eyes and your ears peeled when you're at the glaciers.
Jeff Pietka, thank you so much for being with us. Park ranger and naturalist in one of the great locations on Earth.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us in Glacier Bay National Park. This recording is a copyright production of Holland America Line and is made possible through the cooperation of the rangers and scientists who work and study in Glacier Bay National Park.